This is Weekday. I'm Steve Scherr. The evening of July 9th, 1776, New York City, His Excellency George Washington, directed by Congress, had his troops marched into various assembly grounds for a reading of the Declaration of Independence. The army had been at war for a year already. They were tired, they were diseased, they were tattered. They'd just recently arrived in New York after laying siege to British troops in Boston. The Declaration was read, and then following great cheers, a crowd ran down the street of Broadway, went to Bowling Green, where there was a statue of King George III in grandeur on a horse sitting in front of Washington's actual headquarters. Crowds threw ropes around the statue, pulled it down, whacked off the head, chopped off the nose, put the head of King George III on a pike, hung it in front of a tavern, and melted down the rest of the statue for bullets. 1776, ahead on Weekday.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Giles Snyder. Testimony is underway in one of Mississippi's most famous civil rights era murder cases. Reputed Ku Klux Klan member Edgar Ray Killen is charged in the 1964 slayings of three workers who were registering black voters in the state. NPR's Debbie Elliott is covering the trial.
The state's first witness was Rita Bender, formerly Rita Schwerner, wife of Michael Schwerner, who was killed along with James Chaney and Andrew Goodman. Bender testified that the couple received constant threats in 1964 after they moved from New York to work in the civil rights movement. She told of the last time she saw Mickey, as she called her husband, and how the three workers disappeared after traveling to Neshoba County to investigate a Klan church burning. Under cross-examination, Bender admitted she had no personal knowledge linking Edgar Ray Killen to the crime. The 80-year-old Killen was not in the courtroom during testimony and was later taken from the courthouse on a stretcher to have his blood pressure checked. Debbie Elliott, NPR News, Philadelphia, Mississippi.
A compromise has been struck between Sunni Arab groups and leaders of a Shiite-dominated committee writing Iraq's new constitution. The deal ends weeks of deadlock over how big a presence Sunnis will have in drafting the charter. Under the deal, 15 Sunni Arabs would join two others already sitting on the committee. 10 more Sunnis will also join the panel as advisors. Five U.S. Marines have been killed in a roadside explosion near the Iraqi town of Ramadi. NPR's Deborah Amos reports from Baghdad.
For the second time in a week, the Marines have suffered high casualties in the same area around Ramadi. U.S. military officials also reported the death of a naval officer from small arms fire in Ramadi. Most sailors are medics when deployed with the Marines. A website that tracks military casualties reported 11 U.S. soldiers killed between June 9th to June 11th by what the U.S. military calls improvised explosive devices. IEDs, or roadside bombs, are now the leading cause of casualties. The commander of the U.S. Army's IED Defeat Task Force said insurgents have learned to design explosives that could penetrate battle tanks as well as armored Humvees. The best defense, he said, was to take down the insurgent cells, creating more sophisticated weapons. Deborah Amos, NPR News, Baghdad.
President Bush is denouncing tomorrow's Iranian elections as designed by the country's religious hardliners to help them cling to power. In a written statement, Mr. Bush says the elections are, in his words, sadly consistent with the Iranian government's oppressive record. The election will choose a successor to President Mohammad Khatami. Initially, the Guardian Council, which is run by clerics, barred reformers from running, but that ruling was later reversed. On Wall Street right now, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up 13 points at 10,570. In moderate trading of 501 million shares, the Nasdaq Composite Index is up 10 points. This is NPR News.
94.9 KUOW, NPR News and Information. I'm Deborah Brandt. The city of Seattle is selling two Seattle Center parking lots to housing developers for $7.6 million. The money will offset the debt for the center, which has lost money the past 4 years. Earlier this year, the city sold another parking lot at the center to the Gates Foundation. University of Washington officials are talking to state lawmakers about dramatically increasing tuition. The president says the $5,100 tuition could go to $10,000 over a period of time. The UW would use the money to attract and retain top professors, making it more like a private institution. If Southwest Airlines moves to Boeing Field, it would leave more than some empty gates at SeaTac Airport. It also would leave an $8 million hole in airport revenue, about 6% of the total. SeaTac says that could force it to cut back on expansion or increase the cost for remaining airlines. one of the best-known bloggers on the Internet, organizes an annual conference called Nomadex. The three-day conference is being held next week at the Bell Harbor Conference Center in Seattle. About 300 people are paying $400 to hear discussions on blogging, podcasting, and digital legalities. Our forecast is calling for cloudy skies with a 50% chance of rain today, mainly this afternoon, 60% chance of showers tonight, and 60% tomorrow. The high today, 66, the overnight low, 52. Tomorrow's high, 65. Wind will be light and variable. We have cloudy skies, 59 degrees in Seattle at KUOW.
The NPR shop gets ready for summer storms. Our new array of products will help you anticipate and prepare for whatever blows in this summer. Available at npr.org.
This is Weekday. I'm Steve Scherer. The lesson of 1776, one lesson anyways, perseverance. It was Washington's watchword, it seems, and a sentiment that fit him, according to David McCullough, the Pulitzer Prize-winning historian who's written 1776, a companion to his previous biography of John Adams. David McCullough has won two Pulitzer Prizes, two National Book Awards. He's been an editor, a teacher, a familiar TV host of Smithsonian World and the American Experience. He's been elected to the American Academy of Arts and Sciences and has received 31 honorary degrees. He joins us in our studios. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, sir. Glad to be here.
May I ask, I included that because I'm just curious, what does it mean when you get an honorary degree, and what are 31 honorary degrees? Do they sit on your wall? Are they all?
No, I haven't put them. I put one up. I have one on my wall. Nobody's ever asked me that. It's a good question. It's my honorary degree from Yale, which is where I went to college, and so it means the most to me. Very often it's because I've been invited to be the commencement speaker, but sometimes it's they're called to say they'd like to give me an honorary degree, and would I like to be the commencement speaker? So it's not a commensurate on whether I speak or not. And I always like to be the commencement speaker because I, oddly, really like commencements. I think they're one of the great last surviving ceremonies in American life. We have very little ceremony or celebration in American life anymore. And it's all for, and it's for such a good cause. It's to celebrate achievement, to celebrate worthy work, and a great turning point in people's lives, needless to say, or should be. But also, it brings together such a cross section of grandparents, parents, people from all walks of life, people from every part of the world now, and I love them. And to see those young people about to launch into the world is, to me, exciting.
So the degree has meaning. It has meaning for you on a personal
level. It has
level.
Great meaning for me. And the honorary degree has great meaning. And I'm not a PhD historian. I was an English major in college. And to have, it's really 39 colleges and universities honor me with their highest honor. And if you believe, as I do, that our colleges and universities are among the highest levels of attainment of a civilization, not always great, not always doing the right job, not always the happiest atmosphere, but if you really do believe a great university is something to be strived for in a civilization, and a great university confers a degree on you, that's huge. Moment in life. It certainly has been for me.
That's good. I like that. I was struck in reading this book, just to follow up on that idea of the faces before you, I was struck by how much of this book is drawn from the first-person accounts of the people that were there. And so not just the hundreds of letters from Washington and Greene and others, but also the journals of all these different privates and soldiers and shopkeepers. Was there more of a tradition of that than there is today, or was it because everybody knew they were in something momentous that they had written it and so it got published?
No, there was much more of a tradition. That's how you communicated. There were no cell phones, to say the least. There were no FedEx, no telephone.
So letter and journal, though.
Letters and journals. And we don't write letters and journals anymore. There isn't a politician who would dare keep a diary anymore. It could be subpoenaed and used against them. Terrible shame, because we're going to leave very few records of how we feel, what we're worried about, the inner person. And writing a letter in that day was also considered something you did. That was what you were supposed to do. If you went away, you were supposed to write your mother. If you went away, you were supposed to write your wife. So for me, the most valuable and in many ways the most gratifying sources for this book were the letters of people like Joseph Hodgkins, who was a cobbler, shoemaker from Ipswich, Massachusetts, and the diaries of Jabez Fitch, who was a farmer from Connecticut, or the memoir of John Greenwood, the little boy who walked Portland, Maine to Boston to sign up as a fifer, walked 150 miles all by himself to become a soldier, and he looked about 12, but he was 16. Or Joseph Plum Martin, another Connecticut farm boy who had wrote an incredible memoir about what happened to him.
Now, was that published? Was that a published memoir?
Yes, they were. Some of these things were published in the 19th century, when there was much more interest in the Revolutionary War than there is or has been since. But often they were often published in historical journals, the Journal of the New York Historical Society, let's say, or the Connecticut Historical Society. And you can get it that way in print, but sometimes you have to go back and double check, because they would often leave things out without including ellipses to show you where you're missing something.
Well, was it? Yes, this is Fitch's that you have a page of, a picture of it. They were good, right? They had pretty decent. Not all of them, I understand, did, but they had some of them had pretty decent.
Henry Knox's diary, which I also reproduce in the book, is all but illegible. But when you consider when he was writing it and under what conditions, it's very understandable. And it's reproduced in the book, its actual size. It's closer to the front.
Oh, all right.
It's reproduced in its actual size because I want the reader to see how small it was. One more toward the front. To see how the idea that this guy would have kept any record, considering everything that he was up against,
that was the one more. I was just reading the pictures. Oh, that's right. Sorry. I should remember.
Take a look at it.
I can't read it.
That's right.
Yeah. I can see the word Albany in there. Lots of crossing out.
Yeah.
But he kept it all the time.
He kept it all through that incredible exploit of his, which is, to me, like something out of myth. The idea of this 25-year-old Boston bookseller with no military experience would have an idea, get the idea all the way to the top, to the commander-in-chief, and the idea is preposterous that he's going to go to Ticonderoga, way up in upstate New York, and haul the cannon from Ticonderoga all the way to Boston, 300 miles in the dead of winter, and Washington likes the idea, likes the young man, and says, all right, you do it. And he does it.
What does that tell you about Washington? Before it tells you something about Knox, what does it tell you about Washington?
That he has a terrific eye for ability. And he picks out Nathaniel Greene and Knox right away, within the first 2 weeks that he takes command.
And Knox is a bookseller.
Yeah, and Greene was a Quaker iron master.
Self-taught. Both of them self-taught.
Well, as was Washington. I think he's seeing himself in those men. They're both big fellows, like he is. And they both have the equivalent of about a fifth-grade education. But they are not uneducated. Both of them are avid readers, and everything they know about the military, all that they know about the military, is from books. But you see, it was the 18th century, and that was an era when it was thought that a good way to learn things was to read it in books.
Yeah, there was one book that I think it was either Knox or Greene. I think it was Knox, a book that. Of military campaigns?
No, it's about leadership.
Leadership, that was it.
And by Marshall de Saxe. Oh. And the first thing you have is courage, that everything else depends on courage. And all three of these men have courage. But consider that Washington, not only picks these two young men out and Knox is 25. Green's 33, and he made a general 33. He's never set foot on a battlefield in his life. But they are going to stay in the war, those two young men, as does Washington, the whole distance. And they're the only three that do, the only three general officers, in other words, generals. Knox becomes a general eventually. All the others drop by the wayside. And these two that Washington himself pick are the two that go the whole way. And Greene becomes the best general we have as a tactician and strategist.
So when you
and he's a Quaker.
Yeah, a fighting Quaker, isn't that what he said?
Fighting Quaker.
Determined to be a fighting Quaker?
Yes. The Quakers play a very interesting role in this war. Thomas Mifflin, who becomes a general at about 35, is the in effect the hero of the miraculous retreat from Brooklyn, and then of course Thomas Paine, who gives words to this creed and cause, is also a Quaker.
When you let me come back to Quakers, but let me ask you a question. When you look at these guys and you note that it's perseverance. And it's a decision to be courageous because, or for Washington, something about his temperament that he doesn't panic when bullets are flying. Is that what it was? I mean, was it in the end that they stuck to it, whereas Howe and the other generals of Britain just didn't have that, they weren't as stubborn?
I don't think you can pin it on any one thing. I think it was a combination of a variety of things. It could have gone either way, the outcome of the war. Could have gone either way at several points, even within the year 1776. 1776 is the most important year of what was the most important struggle in our whole history. And it should not be remembered just for the Declaration of Independence. Needless to say, the noble ideals of the Declaration of Independence are deep in our faith and should be as a democracy. And let's hope always will be. But the Declaration of Independence would have been nothing but a declaration, words on paper, had it not been for what these people with Washington were to accomplish. Now, not all of them were heroes. It's very important to understand that because guys deserted. They quit. They went home. They went over to the enemy by the hundreds, by the thousands. And it was those that didn't, those that stayed the course. Staying power, I would say, was a big part of what decided things.
Including that fife player, by the way, right?
Yes, indeed.
He stayed
Little John Greenwood. And I love his name. It's like something out of Shakespeare or a Dickens. You know, you name him for... He's Greenwood. He's a green soldier. He's about as green as any soldier could be. And his genuine... The genuineness of his recollections is powerful. It's like something out of literature.
Did you read them, by the way? You read them in the first... Did you get to read them in the first... Did you hold them in your hand, some of these journals?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Some of them. Not all of them. Knox's diary, for example, which you just were looking at, that's in the Massachusetts Historical Society. And to hold that in your hand, it's about the size of your hand, and realize what that diary went through on that trek from Ticonderoga. They did it, of course, by using giant sleds and by hiring... Teamsters and so forth and so on. But it's unbelievable. You know, there were no roads. It was wilderness. They couldn't come down the Massachusetts Turnpike.
Let me get that story and your questions for David McCullough. And when we come back, a further exploration of why the year 1776 was important.
Support for KUOW comes from the Cottage Company, now offering its 2005 community, Danielson Grove in Kirkland, 14 three-bedroom bungalow homes on a garden courtyard. Model home open Sunday 1 to 4. Details online at cottagecompany.com. Support for KUOW comes from Carter Volkswagen in Ballard, introducing the fifth generation new Jetta, featuring German engineering and technology. The retooled and restyled Jetta can be seen at the showroom or online at cartervw.com. In Ballard since 1960, home of the hassle-free loan car.
Pulitzer Prize winner, historian David McCullough, has written 1776. If you have questions, comments, thoughts, join in this conversation at 206-543-5869, 1-800-289-5869, or email us weekday at kuow.org. Why was, just to lay it out, why was 1776 such a critical year?
Because we shifted from fighting for our rights as freeborn Englishmen, as we were doing at Lexington and Concord and Bunker Hill, to fighting for independence. And then with that movement came the creed of the Declaration of Equality, all men created equal, and the rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. So that gave a larger and more noble reason for to fight. It enlarged the cause. They called it the Glorious Cause of America, and with the Declaration of Independence, it of course became more glorious. Though you don't see that in the letters and diaries of the soldiers. You don't see the words life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. You don't see much at all about the Declaration of Independence. You see it in the writings of some of the officers, like Greene and Knox, for example. But that doesn't mean they weren't talking about it. And one of the lessons that Washington learns as the war proceeds into 1776 is that we can't fight this war depending on the patriotism alone of these soldiers. We have to pay them. We have to give them a bonus, a promise of land. We have to make sure that their widows and orphans will be taken care of. In other words, they must become a professional army. Now, we Americans were very leery about regular or professional armies. That's one of the reasons people had left Europe to get away from all that. So there was a good deal of resistance, but Congress finally came around, and came around as did Washington. It wasn't that Washington persuaded them to. And so this is a big change because they only signed up for a year at a time or less. And when their enlistments were up, they had the right to go home. So every year at the end of the year, Washington faced the terrible prospect that his whole army might just walk off,
go home. You have him describing scenes where he's in despair.
Absolute despair. In fact, one of the most memorable and I think touching moments and a true picture of George Washington is on December 30th at the end of 1776 in Trenton when he announces that any guy that signs on for another year, all the enlistments up are going to be up the next day. And he tells them, if you sign on, I'll give you $10 for the next 3 months extra, a bonus. Well, now, that sounds to us absolutely pathetic, but when you think that their pay was $6 a month, this was a big promise. And he had no authority to do that. And he calls them all out into formation, and he gets up in front of them and delivers an impassioned and as one of the accounts says, affectionate, very interesting word, affectionate speech. And
because he has changed his feelings towards these soldiers?
No, I think because his manner was not to show affection for them. His manner was to have respect for them. And Washington was a leader who believed there should be some distance between officers and enlisted people. That was the military manner. He says that all those who will stay with me step forward, and the drums roll, and nobody steps forward. So Washington turns on his horse and starts to ride away. But then, being Washington, he turns around and comes back and does it again. And this time, it works. They step forward. Now, he won't give up. And that's in many ways, one of his most salient and all-important qualities. This man won't quit.
If you will consent to stay 1 month longer, you will render that service to the cause of liberty and to your country, which you can probably never do under any other circumstance. I mean, what do you suppose, I mean, from what you've read, in these soldiers, what do you suppose propelled them to take that step at the second and not the first?
Him. Yeah. It's like a Shakespeare, you know. It's like Henry V. He's saying, men in their beds will wish they were with us today. You know, he's saying, this is your one chance. This is a real opportunity of a kind you're never going to have again to serve your country. That's powerful. But it's also, he liked Shakespeare. I'm not saying he took this from Shakespeare, but John Adams called Washington the greatest actor of his time. And he didn't mean that in a derogatory way or critical way. He saw that as that was Washington's. He knew how to play the part of a leader and to look the part of a leader. And he was a leader. But this is great theater. And Washington understood that. He loved the theater. This is one of the interesting things about him. And he loved particularly the play Cato, which he had performed for the troops later on, not in 1776. And much of what he, Knox, others felt about their roles in this drama of the American Revolution comes from their notion of the theater. They talk about the stage of history, the drama of our time. We must play our parts. We have been cast in one of the great dramatic moments in all time, and future generations will judge us on how we play our parts. So this is a sense of history, which, as a sense of history always should do, doesn't just convey an appreciation and understanding of what happened before, but that your own time is part of history, and that how you behave in your own time will be judged by future generations.
But describe the state of these soldiers he was talking to at this point.
They're absolutely wretched. They are in rags. They are hungry. They are almost starving. They have no winter clothes. This is the dead of winter. Many have no shoes. The old stories of Washington soldiers leaving bloody footprints in the snow, those stories are true. And they have very little experience with victory. They just won the Battle of Trenton, which is of infinite importance, not as a military victory just, because it was a relatively small conflict. It wasn't a huge battle like the Battle of Brooklyn, which we lost pathetically. But it was the impact on American morale that was so important about Trenton. It transformed the morale not just of the Army from a very low to a reasonably low state, but it also transformed the morale of the country. Particularly people whose sons or husbands or brothers were in the war.
But yet, as you say, this is 1776. There's 6.5 more years of horrendous conflict.
Yes, longest war in our history except for Vietnam. Most people don't understand that or realize that.
And these guys, and Washington had, this was the 1 year of many years where he was begging for Congress to send him money and begging his soldiers to stay with them and, wanting a more professional-looking soldiery. It's hard to see how these soldiers, diseased, as you said, and in rags and no shoes, it's hard to see how they would step forward at that point when he's offering them
very hard.
Very little.
Very hard. That's why we need to know who they were. They were down to 3,000 men. That's all. And probably
from how many initially?
Oh, at most 20,000. And it all evaporated in less than 6 months. In let's say mid July of 1776, Washington had about 20,000 troops in New York. Now, lots of them were sick then too. And most of them were green as green could be, kids right off farms, no experience at all. And don't picture anybody ever in uniforms except a few officers. And Washington is therefore is sort of superbly conspicuous in his perfect uniform, his beautiful uniform.
Very important to him.
Very important to him. Very important that he looked like a leader. It's the actor. He's got... And it's meticulous. He has his own tailor with him. This is how all has to be right, and he has to also look the part to the enemy. Very important, that scene where General Howe and Admiral Howe in New York send their representatives over to meet with Washington to see if some sort of an agreement, some sort of a reconciliation, can be worked out. And they refused to refer to him as General Washington, in anything that they say on paper. And he refuses to accept anything on paper that doesn't say general. They can't call him General Washington, because that is acknowledging that this rabble mob, this armed rabble in arms, as Burgoyne said, General Burgoyne of the British, that they are in fact an army. And they won't admit that, because if it's an army, therefore it represents a government, and they will not acknowledge that the army is an aspect of a government. So if Washington won't accept anything that isn't set, where he isn't addressed as general, and they won't call him general. But the whole thing is kind of an 18th century charade or tableau in which Washington knows that to gain the respect of those British counterparts, he has to act the part of the great general quite as well as they do. Now, he had served in the British Army, of course, during the French and Indian War. He wasn't a regular in the British Army. He had wanted desperately to become a general in the British Army. And one wonders what might have happened had they been wise enough to say yes. See, I don't think that the outcome would have been the same had there been no George Washington.
So the thing about it is that so he has a tailor, he has a whole entourage with him. He has to go to the best houses, you write about, and he has his slave with him, his manservant who's always taking care of him. And yet he's not to you. He's not a fool or a fop. He's none of those things.
No. But he's not perfect either, and he's not a brilliant general. He's no Napoleon. He makes big mistakes. Almost ends the war with his mistakes, but he always learns from his mistakes.
But he listens to the people he surrounds himself with, too.
Well, yes, and he wants to. When Boston was under siege, he wanted to attack. That was all he wanted to do. He wants to attack, and they keep holding him back. And thank God they did, because it could have been the end of it all right then. It could have been another Bunker Hill, only the reverse, where we were slaughtered instead of the British being slaughtered.
So what do you mean that he made many mistakes but learned from them?
Well, he was completely outflanked, outfoxed, outsmarted at Brooklyn. It was a catastrophe. We lost over 1,000 men taken prisoner, more than 300 killed. We were made to look like amateurs, bush leaguers, which we were. At Kips Bay, our men, when the British crossed over to invade Manhattan itself, at about what's now 34th Street, the green Connecticut troops that faced these regulars coming ashore ran like rabbits. Washington plunges in with his horse, trying to turn them around to fight. They're running, throwing off their knapsacks, their muskets, their hats, everything, trying to get rid of any weight they have so they can run faster. And he loses it. He starts slashing out at them with his riding crop. He pulls a pistol on his own officers, and he gets so close up to the enemy, oncoming enemy. It's only when two of his aides grab the bridle of the horse and pull him off the field that he's taken to safety. Now he could have been shot. He could have been captured. Then they have what was one of the greatest, really catastrophic, tragic defeats at the battle. Siege of Fort Washington, which is up on the high ground, where the George Washington Bridge now comes into Manhattan, and over 3,000 men were taken prisoner, captured, and all their material and all their cannon and everything else, and those were all attributable to him, to George Washington. But he won't quit. He won't say, "Oh, woe is me! I'm pathetic. I can't handle this. Somebody else has to do." He won't do that.
What does he say instead? Because he writes in his letters. What does he say instead?
He very often complains, private correspondence, and there's a strain of self pity. Woe is me! I've got this terrible job and all these people that won't do the right thing and so forth. But he won't give up. And if the French hadn't come into the war later on, if things had gone from bad to worse, I think he would have, and he said so, he would have moved further west. He would have wound up somewhere in the wilds of the mountains of Virginia or Pennsylvania and carried on the war. And it's only in 1776 that the British begin to catch on, and he begins to catch on, that the point of this conflict is not to hold Boston or hold New York or take over New Jersey. The point for the British is get that army and him and kill them, capture them, put them out of business. For him, it's keep this army alive, keep this army fighting. And, of course, he's down to 3,000 men. And in the last part of December, all hope's gone, really. The war is over. We've lost. But he doesn't see it that way. So he does what he felt you have to do when all hope's lost and there's nothing left. You attack. So he stages the night attack on Trenton, one of the most brilliant strokes of his entire career, one of the most brilliant strokes in any war, and he wins. And
armies that were supposed to go with him.
Exactly. There were supposed to be three attacks at once, and the other two pulled back. Again, you see, so it's so symbolic. They won't cross the river because of the ice. They can't do it. He does it. And we all know the painting, and we all know the painting's got some horrendous inaccuracies. That doesn't matter. It symbolizes what is one of the great turning points in history. But the crossing, as tough as it was, as dangerous as it was, as preposterous as it was, wasn't the worst part of the night. It was the march from where they crossed, 9 miles south down the eastern shoreline of the Delaware. That's the worst part, because it's a howling blizzard with snow and God knows what the wind chill factor was, and sleet and hail and everything. And again, we have to bear in mind these soldiers have no winter clothing. Some have no shoes. They're in rags. And I think that all you have to say is that two men froze to death on the march, to have some idea of what they were suffering. Abigail Adams later on said, "Future generations who will reap the blessings will scarcely be able to imagine the hardships and sufferings we've endured." And that's, alas, true. We don't know.
You know, I wonder when you I'll take some calls, but I wonder when you I'll take some calls after the break. I wonder when you look around. Where do you live?
I live in Massachusetts.
So when you walk around Massachusetts, when you walk around New York City, I mean, when you were saying Fort Washington or where the George Washington Bridge came in, do you see it all as history? Do you see the layers?
I do. Yes, I was walking across the Brooklyn Bridge with Brian Williams for an interview. He said, "Now we're up here on this bridge. I mean, can you see Brooklyn the way it was then?" And I say, "Oh yes, absolutely, I can." You soak yourself in this. You get inside that other time, and you really do feel that you're there. I sometimes feel I might just stay there and not come back.
David McCullough is author of 1776. When we come back, your phone calls on weekday KUOW Seattle. Should Southwest Air start flying out of Boeing Field? Ron Sims thinks so. We'll take his comments, your calls, and questions. Next hour on weekday, listener sponsored KUOW.
Support for KUOW comes from Bellevue Square, a shopping destination of more than 200 stores and an East Side dining district that includes the Cheesecake Factory, Pagliacci Pizza, and Red Robin. Store and restaurant information can be found online at bellevuesquare.com.
KUOW and Bookit Repertory Theater present Kate Chopin's The Awakening, a powerful story of a restless young wife discovering her own sexual and emotional autonomy, playing through June 26th. For information, visit our community page at kuow.org.
Support for KUOW comes from the Port of Seattle and the merchants at SeaTac Airport, offering new shopping and dining choices throughout the airport, all located on new map directories at 34 locations in the terminal.
Next time on Day to Day. In the U.S., the number of avid golfers is going down, but in Japan, where 20 years ago golf was king, the sport is in danger of actually falling off a cliff.
If we cannot developing young people, that's a very tough situation.
Trying to save golf in Japan, I'm Alex Chadwick. That's next time on Day to Day.
Today at noon on 94.9 KUOW.
David McCullough is here. We're talking about the history, the Seattle Shakers series that we want to do because I have a historian I can ask about that. David McCullough is author of 1776. He spoke last night at Town Hall, 7:30. And tonight he's going to be reading at the First Baptist Church in Tacoma. That's at 7 on his book on the year that was so critical in American history. Let me bring you into this. Forrest is in Redmond. Hello, Forrest.
Hello. I've been reading.
Forrest, you there?
Yes, I am.
No, Forrest?
Yes, we're here.
Okay.
Oh, you want it? Forrest, you there?
She was.
Really?
Now I don't
hear her. How interesting. All right, Forrest, you go again.
Hello?
All right, there you go.
I've been reading Dr. McCullough's book, and my question is, many of the people were supporting the British, prominent people and others, and they had to leave, and I wanted to know either a comment from him on either how Washington felt about all the support that they were getting, or what happened to those people that were forced to leave the country.
I became very interested in the over 1,000 people who were Tories or loyalists who had to leave Boston and who sailed away with the British fleet when it departed, leaving all their associations and homes and possessions, their whole way of life, sailing away they knew not where, and what motivated them to do that, who were they? They were not just the intelligentsia or the establishment, as we might say, as is often portrayed. They were people from every walk of life. And by far, most of them were people of lower income, tradesmen and so forth. And they thought they were the true patriots. They were loyal to their king. And they did not like what they saw, and which I'm afraid we would see too, as mob rule. We know we've often been taught in history books or in school that people that wouldn't go along were tarred and feathered. And ha, 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 wasn't that fun? Well, it was a form of torture. Imagine having hot tar poured all over your body and then be forced to ride on a rail. It was brutal. It was 18th century brutality. And your question about what became of them is wonderful because it isn't a very encouraging story. Most of them lived what was not an easy or valuable life afterward. The British, many settled in Halifax, and they did all right in Canada, in other words. And others went on to Britain, where they weren't really ever accepted by the British people. And of course, they felt they wouldn't be accepted if they came home. Many in this country, including John Adams, encouraged them to come back. I feel very much the spirit of Lincoln after the Civil War. He wanted them back because he knew many of them were good people, and he knew that many of them had abilities or trades or crafts talent that we needed. The story of the Loyalists is a story that I think needs new attention and more attention, and there's lots of material on it. It's a great opportunity for historians. Much of it is in Britain, much of it in Canada, and much of it in places like Boston and New York. And keep in mind that, for example, that when the British landed at Staten Island, when they returned in such force in the early part of July 1776, and when they invaded Long Island, they were welcomed with open arms, because New York was predominantly loyalist, as was New Jersey. I met last night after I spoke here in Seattle. A man came up to me and he said, I'm descended from loyalists in New Jersey. He said, how much do you have in the book or how much do you know about the loyalists of New Jersey? And I said, a lot. And he said, well, I'm one of them. I said, well, you know, you were in the vast majority in New Jersey. And people forget that. Only about a third of the country was for the revolution. Another third was equally, adamantly, ardently against the revolution. And the remaining third, in the good old human way, were waiting to see who won. when you combine the fact that the revolution had no popular majority with the fact that Washington kept losing or botching one battle, major or minor, over and over, if that whole unfolding of events had been covered by the modern media, I don't think the cause or the war would have had, the revolution would have had a chance.
Well, part of what you you write are accounts of both American officers and also British who see in the rabble, in the soldiery, Negroes,
yes,
as they put it, and that they don't like that.
That's right.
And Washington didn't like that either. And yet these were people who had also chosen to fight for dollars or for freedom, and yet they were, Washington tried to push them out.
Well, he didn't try to push them out. He wanted to exclude them at first. And there were a number of – this was when the army was still in Massachusetts. And there were a number of free blacks who wanted to volunteer and who had signed up with militia units before Washington appeared on the scene. Keep in mind, this is a New England army when Washington takes command. That's all he has. He's the lone Virginian, the lone figure from any other state. And he's there as much for symbolic reasons as for political or military reasons. And he wants to exclude blacks, but when he sees toward the end of 1775 that his army is evaporating, people are just getting up and going home, and he needs everybody he can get, and he realizes because he's talking to these New England officers that the black soldiers are just as good as anybody else, he changes his point of view and says, well, we will include black soldiers. This is a very big step. Here's a slave master who is saying blacks can serve in this army along with everybody else equally.
So is it expedience? He realizes he only has a third of the support of the population. Or is there in that, do you read in that the inkling of Washington's evolution over time and his views on slavery that by the time he dies, his views on slavery have evolved?
I think his view on slavery is pretty much known and understood. He thought it was something that ought to be dispensed with, gotten rid of. His whole way of life, his whole economy of his own Mount Vernon plantation was based on it, of course. But when you look at the fact that how he decides that it is to a large extent expedient, of course. He doesn't have much choice. I think he judged people more on the individual. And if an individual was a black person, he was a good soldier, he was a good soldier for him. His manservant, Billy Lee, was probably the second greatest horseman of his day. Washington was widely viewed as the greatest. Billy Lee could ride like the wind. And he didn't just want Billy Lee with him all through the war because he was his servant. He wanted Billy Lee with him because he knew Billy Lee was his kind of guy. And when Phyllis Wheatley, the black poet, wrote a poem in his honor when he was in Boston, the night before one of the crucial days in the whole struggle at Boston, he sat down and wrote her a very nice letter, praising her for her talent and saying that if she would have the chance to come by to see him, he would love to meet her. So this is not a man who's locked into a rigid caste system or deep racial prejudice or anything, near as I can tell.
I wondered because the British at this point were already moving away from slavery, at least at home, if not in their trade. So am I right to remember that at some point the British also said to blacks who were slaves and also who were free, you know, join us and you'll get freedom.
That's right.
So was there in the Loyalist, the idea that Forrest brought up, was there in the Loyalist view also that sort of underlying that growing American sense in New England that, you know, people should be free?
Yes, of course it could be. It was on both sides. John Adams, for example, and Abigail Adams were adamantly opposed to slavery and never owned a slave as a matter of principle. He was the only founding father who never did own a slave. Remember, slavery wasn't just in the South. Slavery was everywhere.
Yeah, New York City, right?
Franklin had slaves. Hamilton had slaves. But that doesn't mean that there weren't people who were against it. And the anti-slavery movement begins. Benjamin Rush, who started the anti-slavery movement in Philadelphia, owned slaves. So it's a very complicated thing. We say to ourselves, how in the world could that be? What could be more hypocritical?
By the way, has anybody written about Billy Lee, or has Billy Lee written any of his Anything down anywhere?
There's very little about him. I tried as best I could to find everything that was available, and very little about him. He lived to be quite an old man and stayed on at Mount Vernon. Washington freed all of his slaves at his death, and Billy Lee was sort of a person that people came to see when they came to Mount Vernon, because he became quite well known.
I mean, it must have been an interesting fellow to have been a fox hunter with Washington and been through all the war with him.
Wouldn't you love to hear his story?
Yeah.
If you could interview him, truly. I think about that often, of people I'd love to sit down and interview, or what they know, or what they knew, and people who were witness to so much of history. Jefferson's daughter, for example. I think I'd give the world to interview her, because she was there for almost all of it. She was his first lady, so to speak, at the White House. She was with him in Paris.
And she wrote nothing?
Very little.
Following up on that, Bruce is in South Seattle. Hello, Bruce.
Hello there. Yeah, South Seattle. I'm parked finally off the road. I've often been wondering about the feelings of the loyalists. Like your guest there, I'm a descendant from some loyalists that went to Canada, but I'm also descended directly from Dr. Brown, who was with Washington in New England, and from the McLaughlin at Culloden in 45. And I've heard my mother and my grandmother talk about when the families came from the old country, and I'm wondering whether, you know, we talk about empire loyalists as being loyal to the government, but my impression is that being torn away from the families that were still back on the old sod, so to speak, was just as heartbreaking as having a government breakup. Could you comment a little bit about the personal aspects of some of these thoughts?
I think that's a wonderful observation, because I do know of one letter of one of the people who was leaving Boston and parting with everything he had. He said his only objective was to see his wife safely back in Scotland, that they were going to go back again to where they came from, because this was more than they wanted in the way of life, this turmoil. We must remember that the 18th century was a time of tremendous change, tremendous revolutions of all kinds going on, intellectual ideas, changes in science, changes in politics, changes in shifting populations. And no one year was can you just say, well, this is the 18th century. It's always an amalgam of all kinds of things from the past, from what was happening in the immediate present and what was still to come, foreshadowing things. But the loyalists, there's their loyalty to their king and to the freedoms of the British Constitution. The British had more freedom. A British subject had more freedom than anybody in the world. And when the British people heard that we were revolting against what was the greatest amount of freedom that anybody had ever had, they couldn't understand that. Furthermore, we Americans in the colonies along the eastern seaboard had the highest standard of living of any people in the world, which is not well understood. And so how could we, who were living under the freest form of government and had the highest standard of living, not be willing to pay what they saw as our fair share of the taxation and be disloyal to the king, who, of course, was king because of the will of God, I mean, divine right. It went against very deeply against the grain of many people.
I'm going to run out of time, and there are many questions. But since I didn't get back to it, I just wanted to. Jonas writes, "What about the Quakers and their role in all this? Tom Paine was a Quaker, as you said. Green, why were there fighting Quakers? Seems like an oxymoron."
Thomas Paine said it in his wonderful the way. He said, "The sun never shined on a cause of greater worth." And it was the cause, as he said. These are the times that try men's souls, you know. And we have the chance to remake the world. And let's not stand by twiddling our thumbs. Let's give it everything we have. And It would be hard to overestimate the importance of what Paine wrote. Paine's words, Paine's Common Sense, which is published in 1776, and The American Crisis, which was published in 1776, have far more influence on the point of view, the heart of the Revolution, than does the noble Jefferson words of the Declaration of Independence. They are reaching the common people, the common soldier, sooner than the Declaration of Independence, by nearly 6 months, and they are written for them in words they can understand.
So was it written in a way to those people who, though they were told they had the freedoms, maybe because of economic issues or others, didn't really?
No, it isn't about economics. It's about remaking the world with self-government, with democracy, and
so it really resonated.
Oh yes, our first bestseller was Common Sense, published in January 1776. Now it wasn't a book; it was a pamphlet, and it was published anonymously because this was treason. You didn't put your name on these things. The first expressions of "we want a Declaration of Independence" are very hard to find on paper because even after the people who signed the Declaration of Independence had done so, the names on the list, who had signed it, was kept secret on into the next year.
David McCullough, I we could probably go on a couple more hours on this because it does live and breathe for you. I think that's what makes it so much fun.
Well, it should live and breathe for all of us. It's who we are and how we came to be who we are. And history isn't the dead past. History is alive. History is about human beings and human nature. And those people were every bit as real, in some ways maybe more so than we are. And we owe more to them than we know.
David McCullough will be reading tonight, First Baptist Church at 7. Thanks for your phone calls and emails. Thank you very much for talking with us. Lessons of 1776, perseverance, leadership, the power of individuals to make a difference. Also luck, the double-edged nature of bad weather and disease during war. The other lesson, the value of journals and first-person accounts, what little we can discern from the accounts of the people there. Personal histories, it's how we shape our broader notions of history. Hence our look at history and the people who shape it coming up this summer. I don't know what happened there. We're having some technology breakdown today. Did I get to say that I wanted people to send in their suggestions for all historians for their Seattle Shakers? Getting to talk to David McCullough is great about it. He suggested perhaps make sure we think about the steel workers. I was thinking about the old Wobblies that are still there. A lot of oral history yet to be documented. Help us do that. Let's get a look at traffic.
There's still a lot to look at. Let me tell you, there's a disabled truck blocking a lane southbound I-5 south of downtown Seattle as you approach the I-90 overpass. It's in the main line, and it is causing a snarl just as you approach it. And it also affects the express lanes through downtown Seattle. They're heavy from Mercer down to the convention center where everybody rejoins the main line. And South 5 slows at the Ship Canal Bridge in the main line. Eastbound 520 is still lined up I-5 to the water. I-90, the better bridge. Northbound 5 into Seattle is struggling from the Michigan curve all the way to Seneca Street. Northbound 405 is still heavy from the S-curves to Coal Creek and again through North Bellevue. And southbound, that's an unusually heavy backup as you head from Northeast 195th approaching the Bothell-Woodinville interchange into Kirkland. Nothing blocking there, though. And also, that right lane closure is still in effect southbound 99 on the Alaskan Way Viaduct, not far from the ferry terminal, and that's to repair the guardrail from an overnight crash. This look at traffic is brought to you by Alaska Airlines. Sarah Johnson for KUOW.
Thank you, Sarah. National Weather Service says we're going to see rain and all sorts of other stuff today. We'll see if that does occur. It is 62 degrees outside the studios of KUOW, Seattle.
Support for KUOW comes from QFC, celebrating 50 years of serving customers as a neighborhood grocery with stores throughout the Puget Sound area. The employees would like to thank their customers for shopping at QFC. Weekly circular online at qfconline.com.